Now blast off. There we
Love
go.
Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. It once again I'm locked up in memory. They all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Alrighty. Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2620. That's 2620. Tonight we have a guest who's going to be telling her story. We do this on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And we're always so happy when people do come on and, tell their stories. And so her name is Jessica Riley, and she is from Glenmore, Pennsylvania. She probably doesn't live that far away from me. That could be. But anyway, the point is, she's going to be here tonight. She's got quite a bio. I'm certainly not going to start reading all of that. And she probably knows that, in fact, I know she knows how to do the show tonight. So she'll start with, the first time that she was assaulted and so forth and so on and go from there. We do have a panel. And we have Bill here. Now he's called in. And so we have quite a panel going on here. This is good. Okay. So let me read the mission statement, and then I'll get right to our guest. Okay. We have a singleness of purpose at NASCA, and that is to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways. Number one is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic, which we know, it's worldwide, and number two, offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Prevention is so important. They're all important, but prevention is very, very something that we need to, really be involved with as a society, neighborhood, communities, whatever. We also have a very good website page. I like to mention that. If you go to NASCA, that's NAASCA.org, that's NASCA.org. You'll see all kinds of information, and you scroll down a little bit, and you see red lines, and just open those lines up, and you'll find out all kinds of information that help you understand about child abuse. And those that are survivors that listen to this show, and there are many, okay, you learn things just from the information that we have right on the website. So it's really, really good, okay. So enough of that. We have Jessica Riley with us from Glenmore, Pennsylvania. Hello, hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on this evening. It's such a pleasure to be on with you all tonight.
Well, we're so happy to have you on. Every time our voices speak, as we speak, people learn things, they identify with us, and then we teach more about child abuse, and that is just plain so, so important. So, again, I thank you, okay? So why don't you start from the beginning? Go ahead, and
okay.
We'll go from there.
So, thank you. The beginning. Mm-hmm. So I was born in 1969 in London, England, to American parents who were both from pretty wealthy families. They had both gone to Ivy League schools, and they had both grown up in Washington, D.C., and were part of the society, Washington, D.C., upper crust. They were the kind of families where everything looked good on the outside, but nobody really knew what was going on behind closed doors. So I guess my parents met when they were in college, and they had escaped their parents, who both of my parents, as I said, grew up in alcoholic households. So they met in college and ran off to London together, I think to escape what was going on in each of their, you know, family of origin households. So the story is that my parents, Americans living in London, married happily for 7 years, and then suddenly both my parents lost their only brothers. My mother's only brother died of heroin in college. My father's only brother excused himself from the dinner table one evening and went upstairs and shot himself in the head. So I feel like my telling this story now is sort of, I'm doing it on behalf of my two uncles who died in their 20s who never got to tell their stories. I think this stuff has been going on for generations, and I'm just honored to be able to tell my story tonight with you all. So anyway, I don't remember much of my childhood. I was very blanked out as a child. I had very pictures of me looking very vacant and sad, but in beautiful clothes and beautiful houses and stuff, you know. So then when I was about 4 years old, my mother's entire family started dying. So she was flying back and forth to the States to attend funerals, leaving me alone with my father. So she was gone. Her grandmother died, her father, her only brother. Eventually she came back. The abuse must have escalated while she was gone. She caught him in the act when I was 6 years old, and he then left us alone in England. So at that point, my mother treated me as if I was some sort of sexual rival, and blamed me for my father leaving, or that's what it felt to a six-year-old child. We had to pack everything up and move back to the States to begin with my mother's mother, who for her was, you know, it was her entire family as well. So meaning women in the family and my seven-year-old self come over from England and we moved in together. My mother then went back to school, met a wonderful man, got remarried. I was thrust in as the literal redheaded stepchild with an English accent into a, you know, American all-girls school system with funny clothes, funny accent. You know, to say that I felt different would be an understatement. So I started studying people and trying to figure out how to fit in because I felt like almost like a sociologist had been coming in from another country. And I just felt like such an outsider. I really wanted to fit in. So I studied. And I think looking back, I was always very lonely and looking for acceptance as an only child and as a, you know, at best, you know, neglected child. I felt very alone, was looking for friends in the States to fit in. So I became sort of a masterful observer of human behavior and learned how to pretend to be what I thought people wanted me to be so that I would get the approval that I felt that I needed, but that I wasn't getting from at home. And I think my poor little self-esteem had been so broken by my childhood trauma that I didn't know who I was without seeing approval mirrored in the faces of others. So I was always looking outside of myself for external reflections of who I was. And I guess because that's such a desperate position from which to live your life, I found myself just never being satisfied. I set these ridiculously high goals for myself and just nothing ever satisfied me. I never enjoyed myself to achieve the goal. So whether it was, you know, the way that I looked, let's say it was losing weight or studying or, you know, outperforming someone on a sports field or whatever it was, I had to be the best or I didn't want to do it at all because I literally didn't know who I was without some sort of external approval like the, you know, a blue ribbon or an A. So this is a very sort of empty life that I lurched around, became quite quickly Americanized because I wanted to fit in so badly. And then I started lurching around from school to school because I just decided I couldn't be who I wanted to be at one school. I would just reinvent myself and move to the next school and the next school. So I ended up going to 5 high schools. And I should mention also in my childhood, I was very, very smart always. They would tell me that I was smart, but I was manipulative, and I would lie to people. I would steal what I wanted. I would, I would injure myself as a child to get to go to the hospital and get attention. Just strange behavior, you know. Stealing candy from the store just because I wanted to. And I, in retrospect, I look back at it now and I feel like, you know, these are all textbook red flags or blaring sirens of childhood trauma. But I was punished. They would say, why are you lying, Jessica? Why are you stealing? Why are you doing this? Why? What's the matter with you? Why are you behaving this way? So I then internalized all of the shame and really felt that there was something wrong with me. For a long time, and then I lurched around, as I said, between like trying to be the best at everything, and that was just to cover up from, you know, how empty I felt inside, I think. So I did that. And
why don't we slow down? Why don't we slow down there, okay? And the reason being is I don't want you to go through your whole story quite so fast, because we have 90 minutes. So, yeah, that's it. So we're going to fill that in. I have a panel here, too, who want to be introduced to you, and they may have a question so far. You've already given us quite a bit of information, and the abuse that you went through, I understand, too, and certainly around 6 years old. I understand that well. First of all, we have Pamela. She's the assistant producer for NASCA, and maybe she has a question, okay, or make a comment. Go ahead and say hello to our guest.
All right. Hi, Jessica. It's Pamela.
Hi,
again,
Pamela.
I'm so happy. Hello. I'm so happy you are telling your story here for us at NASCA and for yourself to, help part of your healing journey and others to hear your story knowing they're not alone, okay? And certainly wanted to say that you're brave for coming on and revealing your truth. And you said your father was a pedophile. Did y'all learn that he had other victims other than yourself?
I haven't spoken to that man since I was a teenager. So, honestly, I don't know.
Okay. Well, I would hope he didn't get a hold of any others. And he started abusing you when you were a toddler. You said your mother came and walked in on you. What happened during that time?
Well, that's when he left. He just took off. So then I think my mother was expecting him to come back after a couple of days, and after 6 months he never came back and never called or anything, and she, I think, blamed me. So we had to move back to the United States to be with her mother.
And she never turned it in to the police, right?
No, but of course, you know, it happened in a different country.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, and I'll continue listening, and you have a fascinating story of healing, and I can't wait to hear it all.
Thanks, Pamela.
You're welcome.
Yeah. That was good. What we do is we go to the panel and give everybody a chance to say hello and to ask you a question. So now we're going to go down to Darlene from Tennessee, and she's ambassador. She's one of our ambassadors. Darlene, say hi. Maybe you have a question. Go ahead. Darlene, her mic is open.
Hey. Okay, can you hear me now?
Are you there? Yeah, I hear you now.
Hear
go ahead. Go ahead.
I feel like I'm on a Verizon commercial. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Go ahead, ask your question.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Jessica. It takes a lot of courage. And,
thanks, darling. It's great to hear your voice.
And it's nice to hear your voice also. So how many siblings do you have? I must have missed it. I'm kind of like tired today. I hope I didn't miss you saying that.
No, I'm sure it was me, darling. I do tend to talk a little fast. I was the only child until I was about 12 years old, and my mom got remarried and had another child with another man, so she was sick.
Do you think that that child was abused as well?
No, because she had a different father.
Okay. Was, you know, with the rate of the pedophilia going around, you know, you never know, because sometimes you end up marrying another pedophile. You know what I'm saying?
So, oh, for sure, but yeah, no, the other guy is this. My mom went to like 7 years of therapy in between the two husbands, and got her act together, thank God. So the second guy, my stepdad's wonderful. He's been married to my mom for 40 years.
Oh, that's awesome. So he was a positive role model for you, baby. That is wonderful to hear. And I'm sorry you had to experience your father doing this kind of stuff. I also had to endure that since birth, you know. So, but I'm not here to share my story. I'm here to show empathy and to show you that I care. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Darlene.
Yeah, thank you, Darlene, for that. And now we have William from Alabama. Do you have a question,
Hello.
William?
Yeah, that's good. I've just been listening to the beginning of her story, and it's kind of interesting. But I'm glad she's on NASCA tonight, and I'm glad she's sharing her story. And I'm waiting to hear more about it.
There you go. Okay, thank you for that, William. And
sure.
Bill, you're here. Would you like to ask a question or make a comment? Bill is our founder. Go ahead.
Well, quite interested in how much you realized what you were doing in terms of when you were describing that low self-esteem drove you to do certain things, like observe people carefully and make selections based on some choices and some observations and so forth. And I'm always interested in how things felt or how a person thought. So I'm guessing when I'm asking, you know, how much of that were you conscious of at the time when you were young, and how much of it is what you've come to believe later because of your studies and your understanding of yourself, if you would?
Gosh, Bill, that's a great question. Yes, I think, you know, what it felt at the time was very different from excuse me for having a hard time articulating this. I wasn't aware. I was reacting without thinking as a child, so I don't think I was aware of the feeling. It was more like a being subconsciously compelled to do something. I'm much more aware now of how it felt then, but only after processing everything through, you know, trauma therapy.
Right, because we learn things in adulthood that are more sophisticated than we're capable of in childhood. So I'm asking you this because I know there are people who are trying to identify as we go along here, and they may not have had, the kind of clarity that that it sounded like at a certain point anyway, that you were having as a child. And you weren't having it as a child. You had it later and realized what you were doing. But children just act out of kind of instinct, you know. I mean, and sometimes our best guess, you know, we don't know. We're not taught these things and so forth. So, no, I really appreciate your being on the show tonight and look forward to more information too, as some of our other panelists have said. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So should I just dive back in there?
Go ahead. You can start. I just want to say something about one thing here, because I'm reading your bio over here. When you were, you know, being abused, for God's sake, and by the time you were 6 years old, that's when my actual sexual abuse started. I was already seeing domestic violence and all that stuff before. But I was just wondering, when you were 6 years old, I mean, you must have been very frightened. Were you frightened? I know I was. I was scared to death. Were you scared to death?
Yeah, of course. But I wasn't allowed, I didn't grow up in a house where I was allowed to have any needs. So I had to pretend that I was, I'm fine, just fake smiles. So because of that, I really lost touch for many, many years completely with who I was. I mean, I could only access anger. That was the only emotion that I had access to, and everything else was just fake smiles. Because that was, that it took me many years to go back and learn how to integrate that.
And I want to tell you, too, that you see, this is why we have these shows, too, identification. I used to be a people watcher because I had no boundaries. I had no training. I had nothing. So I would look at people to see how to behave and look at the kids and see how they behave. That sort of like, took me back to my childhood as to, trying to find friends, trying to fit in. And it's a very awkward feeling because we feel so terribly, terribly different anyway. And you walked around with a fake smile. I understand that also. It's a very hard thing when you're being abused as a child and you have no one to turn to. And there wasn't anyone that you could really turn to, I guess, about your abuse. Did you tell anyone during that time about your abuse?
I started when I was so young that I don't even think that I had language for it. I did try to explain at the time, my father was reading the Three Billy Goats Gruff to me, that the nursery, the kid story. And in this child story, there's a troll that lives under the bridge. So in my, three-year-old mind, I put the troll's face on my father's body. So I would have nightmares. I would scream and yell. I would say the troll came in and was, hurting me and touching me. And, so it became a family joke. And whenever anyone broke a plate or we'd go on vacation and something would go missing, they'd say, "Oh, it's the troll. It's Jessica's troll. Ha, ha, ha." They made fun of it instead of really wondering what
trying
was
to analyze what you were doing and what it meant. I understand that. Okay. Yeah. That's rough. Okay. Why don't you continue where you had left off? Okay. Go ahead.
So, gosh, I don't even. So I was changing schools, I guess. Then I realized I could. I got kicked out of a couple of schools. I started getting into a lot of trouble. But really, I came from this, white privilege, and it was so well-spoken and manipulative and so good at, telling people what I could read them and decide what they wanted to hear that I sort of skated through getting kicked out of schools and all this crazy stuff. And I failed out of one college, went to another, graduated by the skin of my teeth. I still went to law school. I still graduated with honors. I ended up just lurching around, got engaged 4 times, broke each engagement, commitment phobe. I just thought on the outside, if I matched resumes with someone, maybe I could find an appropriate husband. It was never about a real relationship. If I loved someone, I just thought I needed to check the things off my list that I needed. I had my law degree, I had a career, now it's time for a husband, go down the line. And I just kept picking men that were just like my father, which I now realize I didn't at the time. But looking back, I kept picking these, narcissistic, handsome, arrogant, manipulative, evil men. And
we
then I kept
that.
Feeling like
we
I was
that.
One. We do. We do. And I didn't have any idea until I was in my late 40s that, I had something to do with all this, I thought that I had all these terrible men that were out to get me, and I never realized that I was recreating my childhood dynamic as an adult to try to fix it again and again and again.
Right.
And until I realized what I was doing and finally got some therapy, that was the only way I could break that cycle of really traumatizing myself, every time, every opportunity that I could get. And I was joking with my therapist, it was almost like I was saying that the trauma was almost like a piece of candy, like trauma candy, I would go looking for it. And I think Pamela was asking me about you know, the fear, and I was so scared as a child that I don't know if my fear level ticker is broken. Like I wasn't able to tell when I was really properly in danger because I think my poor stress adrenal glands had been so depleted as a child, like that I wasn't really able to tell when I was really in danger or not because I was always constantly on high alert my whole childhood.
Well, you were hypervigilant. That's the way it sounds.
Yes.
We're having a lot of background noise, so I'm asking everyone to, turn their, be careful because I have all the mics open. And I don't want to have to close them. That's a pain in the neck. But anyway, just be a little more mindful. If you burp, I can hear you. Okay. I mean, it's that sensitive. Okay. So what I'm getting to here is a lot of times when we're kids and we're, we're traumatized, we're so busy trying to survive that we're not even in touch many times with our feelings. Sometimes we certainly feel fear. You have the flight and you have the fight. And you sound like you were a kid that was always searching and searching and searching, throughout life and even in your teenage years. Tell us a little bit about high school. How did you feel in school? Did you feel different? Or did you go out with friends? Did you have friends? Did you how did it affect your schooling as far as in that level?
Gosh, I mean, my trauma, I think, affected everything until it drove me to a place where I couldn't survive until I had to get my, do real trauma therapy. But, I mean, without boring you guys, I mean, I started, I had gone to an all-girls school from fourth through eighth grade with a very small set of, 40 girls in the class. Middle school was tough for me because I felt like I wanted to, like many girls, wanted to be in the cool cliques, when you're in middle school.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had come in with the same class of girls from England with the weird clothes and the weird the weird accent, I felt like they had me boxed into, the weird English girl and I couldn't change. So I decided after it hurt me desperately that I couldn't be friends with whom I wanted to, I cried my eyes out, and then I realized it sort of until I broke myself open and realized, oh, I can leave. I can go to another school. So I went to another school where I thought I could, get what I wanted. Well, I got into that school, and I got what I wanted, and then I ended up wanting to look cool at that school, so I got kicked out of that school. Well, it could have ruined my whole, career and as my family was concerned, that all my chances of going to the right schools and everything, they kept acting as if I was a real juvenile delinquent. I was like out smoking cigarettes and stealing beers and doing silly stuff, making fake IDs, going into bars.
It says here that you learned
that sort of stuff.
Okay,
just rebellious.
I understand. Right, you were very rebellious. See, this, I'm getting to the crux of the whole thing here, because what happens is when we are so abused and there's not much people, we can't express ourselves and all these other things. You have here that you learn to dissociate and compartmentalize at an early age. So why don't you explain to the people who are listening what you mean by that exactly, so that they can get a better idea as to how you were trying to live your life. And you say you were a mask. A lot of us do that.
Mm.
I understand. And because we don't even know who we are a lot of times. So we put on a fake mask. I understand. I get that.
That's right. That's right.
Yes. Yes. So with the dissociating.
I don't think I was aware of it at the time, but I mean, I could literally like leave my body and just feel like I was watching people talking at my body, but I wasn't listening to what was being said, and I wasn't aware of the energy in the room. Like I just felt like I was like just up and out of my body, almost watching from above.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned to do that very easy on, and now I can do that even if I'm like bored waiting in line at the grocery store. I can go cruise around the room at the grocery store if I want to.
you get bored and you dissociate. That's funny.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Okay.
I can do it as a party trick now. But no, it used to take me some time to sort of feel grounded and get back in my body again, and that I think that's part of trauma too, the body armoring and just getting out of yourself. But the dissociation, I think, taught me then to, as you said, to compartmentalize. And so for me, when I was young, I think I just was looking, I was always very anxious and I think depressed, but I wasn't aware of it because that was just my constant state. But I felt like I was always like just almost had like a high ringing in my ears, like going like so nervous and high strung and going all the time, all the time, all the time, all the time. And then I would go and push myself so hard and, you know, without food and without sleep and just pushing and pushing and pushing and, you know, work for 3 days and get the, you know, superhuman feat. Because I was so disconnected from my body, I was able to really push myself hard and work well academically. So it became,
right.
The disassociation became almost helpful in my academic pursuits and maybe why I was able to work so hard and do so well in school. I don't, despite my very busy, you know, drinking, drugging, other self-destructive tendency career that I had going on all through high school and college.
Okay.
So I could do all of that and get straight A's and, you know, get into law school because I just, I was pushing myself so hard, then I felt some need to push myself that hard to compartmentalize everything into that, like, say, you know, the secret part of my mind where I didn't have to look at it. And then that took so much work that I then had this pressure that I felt I had to relieve. So as I was younger, it was always something self-destructive. But as I said, you know, when I was very small, it was stealing candy. Then I was lying. You know, then as I got older, it got to be, you know, injuring myself. And then when I was in middle school, it got to be eating disorders. And then later on, I discovered different drugs and alcohol, and it just kept cycling through. It didn't matter if it was exercising too much or working too hard or, you know, I could get too into anything. It was just I was looking for something outside of myself to fill this hole that I had in my heart, and I didn't really know why.
Okay, let's stop there. Okay, now remember what you said, hole in your heart. Okay.
Right.
I want you to take a deep breath. Take a deep breath, okay? And you're doing a good job, yes you are. And you have all these things going through your head. You like are hypervigilant, and I understand that because so am I. My mouth, they tell me you could put a speedometer on it, I'd be going 60 miles per hour, okay? So I get it. And that's what we do so often. It's very hard, you know, when you're a kid and, you know, you need something to calm yourself down and also to live your life and feel better about yourself and to fit in. So often we do turn to the alcohol and drug abuse. I certainly did also. And I certainly didn't do things that were, you know, nice. Let's put it that way. I had to learn a lot of lessons, you know, and I ended up out on the street and so forth. But how long do you consider yourself an alcoholic? I'm an alcoholic. Are you an alcoholic also? Or what? Or were you able to stop drinking?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You are also.
I thank God. But it was the alcohol that finally got me to deal with my trauma. I mean, the alcohol helped me compartmentalize it and worked for me until it didn't, you know?
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
So when the alcohol, I knew I wanted to stop drinking, and that's when I had really bad PTSD symptoms, panic attacks, flashbacks, night terrors.
Oh,
I was couldn't sleep. So I could stay sober for 3 or 4 months. I couldn't stay sober because of the trauma symptoms. So I had to go inpatient in for 6 weeks and just get in a space, a little bubble where I could just completely fall apart and be put back together again.
Mm-hmm. I understand that.
So
I suffered horribly from panic attacks, you know. Absolutely. It took over my life because you have panic and then you have panic disorder, okay? And then it turns many times into agoraphobia. And I went through each one of those stages. And, you know, I mean, we do such terrible things when we've been abused, excuse me, and we don't get the help that we need. And this is why people do, you know, cut themselves, they do that, or they overeat, or they undereat. There's just all kinds of things that we do. And Yeah. A part of our mind, I think, you know, knows this. But on the other hand, we can't control it. So the drinking, turning to drinking, so I know with myself, and I'm bringing this out because there's a lot of people listening, and this is how they learn. When we turn to the alcohol, it makes us, we think it's calming us down, okay? And it does and it doesn't. I mean, alcohol is a depressant, and it does calm us down. And like you said, you are able then to, like, get your thoughts more together, okay? And this is what we do because we need to get our thoughts together. Let me go to the panel because I'm sure they're busting there. I'm sure that Pamela has something she'd like to ask you about. Go ahead. Go ahead, Pamela.
Yeah, it's a couple of things, Jessica. Did your dad ever threaten you with death or any kind of injury to any of your family members if you talk?
Yes, of
course. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Of course. So, I mean, my only memories of him are doing things like holding me underwater in the pool and, you know, making me cry and, you know, doing things like holding my security blanket over the fire and threatening to burn it, you know, always really cruel stuff like that. So, you know, I'm sorry, what was the question again?
Oh, it was, did he ever threaten you about telling somebody?
Oh, of course, yeah. So he used to threaten me all the time. And then, I was very concerned when he was gone that he was putting his plan in play, that he was the one who had been killing all the members in my mother's family so that she would go back and forth to the state so that he would be left alone with me, and the abuse escalated, and then that's when she came home and caught him in the act. So in my mind, I had thought that he was capable of killing everyone in my mother's family, and that's why they had all died.
Oh, that's scary. So when did you feel like you started realizing you had no identity? And did becoming an attorney become your identity? I mean, you know, when we're young and we go through all that, we don't develop like we're supposed to, right? We don't, there's Erickson's stages of development, and there's a point where we understand who we are, our identity. So do you recall when you started understanding about your identity? Do you need a...
That's a good question. My identity changed so many times until I became an attorney, and then that became my identity. Because it wasn't fixed on who or what it was, my identity was contingent upon whatever outside people, you know, whatever I was doing at the time, so what school I was in or who I was dating or who my fiancé was or what my job was. But when I graduated from law school and became a criminal prosecutor in Miami, like that became, you're absolutely my identity. And
there you go.
I liked that because my ego needed, something, a title like that, I think.
But, you know, that's kind of like something we do outwardly, but where we really need the help is inwardly, you know? I mean, when did you think you realized during your journey that Jessica needed some inward work, you know, to heal?
Yeah, I mean, I knew a lot. It was so complicated for me because I knew that I had all this, like, darkness inside me, but I didn't really know why. And I knew that I was a good person, but I kept doing these bad things, and I didn't understand what my motivations were, and I wasn't sure if there was some sort of darkness in me. And, I mean, I knew my father was creepy. I knew he did inappropriate things. Like, it was in the court record for the divorce that he took me to a nudist colony when I was 7 or something. We went back to the States. 4 years had passed. My father reappeared on the scene, and this was the 70s. Back then, my mother knew what he had done to me, but she wanted child support. And back then, if the man was paying child support, then visitation was what happened. So knowing what he had done to me, my mother made me go spend weekends with my father when I was, you know, back in the States now, 10, 11, 12 years old. So
wow.
That was the last time I think I saw him. And that's when I really started acting up.
Right.
So
right.
What did you feel right. about your mother because of that?
So
what did you feel towards your
mother? So when I was in, I think until I was through law school, so until my mid-20s, I wanted my mother's approval more than anything, and I could never get it. I felt like I would tap dance, jump high, you know, no matter what I did, I felt like she never, you know, approved of me. And I don't know, I used to feel that it was because of what had happened with my father. Now that I've healed that wound, I can see that, you know, she just wasn't capable of showing me the affection that I needed, and she did that. But I did go through a long period of maybe 15, 20 years when I was enraged with my mother. But by the time I was willing to talk to her about it, she had developed Alzheimer's and, you know, wasn't able to have any meaningful discussions with me. So I've had to process this all sort of on my own, but with her and not on my own, with the support of other survivors and therapists and other 12-step fellowships.
Okay.
But
right.
I could never confront her or my father directly, so on my own to that extent.
Thank you for that. Thank both of you for that. You see, this is what we need to hear. We need to hear about how it affected you throughout your life, how it made you feel, because so many people are hurting so badly inside. And what you're talking about is what people go through, okay? So
right.
To get back to, you know, how you were handling it in school, how it made you feel, the mask that you wore, and turning to alcohol and the drugs and then all the things that Pamela just said to you and bringing that all out, it gives people a better picture. And you're not unique. You know, this is the strange thing. Excuse me. So many of us, our stories are very similar in some ways, but then on the other hand, they're different.
Oh, I know.
Okay, but we all have the same feelings, and the PTSD, you know, the post-traumatic stress disorder that we go through is horrific.
Really,
I'm
going
to be before you start your story, though, I have to go down the list here. Wait a minute. We have Darlene from Tennessee. She may have a question or want to make a comment. Go ahead, Darlene. Oh, Darlene.
Sorry, I had it on mute.
That's what I thought. Go ahead.
To me, it reminds me of back when I was a kid and when I was having to go back and forth from parent to parent type of thing. I felt like I was a tennis ball or something like that. You know, it's like I was trying to develop safe places and everything, and it was kind of hard to develop a safe place when you just, you know, like school at one time was my safe place. But when you're moving around and everything and different things keep happening, it's like you don't really have any safe places. Have you felt that same way too?
Absolutely, yes. I really only felt safe when I was out in nature.
At where?
Out in nature. Because I was an only child, I didn't have anyone to play with. So I was always out in the woods and climbing trees and talking to frogs and stuff. Those were my friends.
Okay,
you were talking to
like
frogs?
Okay. We had 27 acres, and I would go back there, and I would just notice the different shades of green and the beauty of the trees and all that kind of stuff. It was just so beautiful, and I could get some air and not worry about what's happening back there at the house, and I'm just walking around, wandering around. Yeah, so I understand that completely.
Exactly.
I think you probably had a lot of peace that way too, both of you. You know, you go out into the woods. Now, I'm more of a city girl. I feel better in the city, but I can understand the beauty. I know. I'm always different. But, you know, I understand what you're saying.
I would not go out in nature at your place with that bear going around here.
Well, I've got bears and coyotes here, so I don't feel too safe around here. I can't help it. But anyway, I know what you're saying. Yes, I know what both of you are saying. That's good. And we do need to find that inner peace. And I think you can find inner peace if you're not being chased by a bear and a coyote. But anyway, we won't go there. Okay, let's go down to William and see if he has a question or a comment to make.
Yeah, don't mess with the bears.
Oh, God.
Because I used to go out in the woods in Minnesota and stuff, and there was this black bear that was always out there, and he liked this one tree to sharpen his claws on. Me and him had a deal. I stay on the side of the lily pad fishing, and you stay over there and sharpen your claws.
Oh, God. Well, Oh, God.
Anyway.
Well, okay, do you have a question you want to ask, or should I go down to Bill? Go ahead.
Yeah, go on down to Bill.
Okay. Yeah, I saw my first black bear yesterday. I'm still shaking from it. Okay, go ahead. Bill, do you have a question you want to ask or a comment?
More a comment, because I identified with several things in the last segment, and one of them was the being lost at school. I was bounced back and forth between schools many times, and I ended up in a high school for four years, which was very successful to me. For me, it was the only time I ever went, you know, and kind of finished anything. But the first two were horrific, and I just made it through with the skin of my teeth to my third year, and then my third and fourth were quite good. So, and my class had 15 in it when we graduated, starting with 30. So I understand the small school situation too. Then the other comment I want to make is, you know, I too found solace in sort of wild things. This is when I'm, you know, a teenager, for example, or, you know, a grade, middle and high school age person. But, and that would include things like the Boy Scouts, you know, which I was very involved in, things like that. But I also lived in a rural-ish area, and I lived in a city. I've lived in many different kinds of environments. And here's the point. No matter where I was, I felt isolated anyway. I felt alone. Yeah. It didn't matter how many people were around or what activity I was in. I, as a child, felt alone. And I expressed this in some moodiness, but in just having the feeling of isolation, you know, of being lonely and being separate from and being hopeful that the future would be different, because as an adult, I could make decisions that I couldn't make as a child. But I felt trapped in my childhood and very alone in it. Although nature did help me a great deal, even when I went to the stream, to the forest, to the woods, to the fields, I still was alone, and I had that feeling. So I identified a great deal with the last segment, and I just wanted to say that.
Yeah.
Thanks, Phil.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of us, that's how we feel, because, number one, we feel so that we're different. We've been abused. We don't realize that there's an awful lot of other kids, you know, that who maybe have their mask on, okay? And they're abused as well. And we just don't get that. We just, we're internalizing how we feel so often. And we have to find peace some way, one way or another. And now the last, the last segment, as Bill puts it, you said you felt that hole in your heart. Do you remember what you were referring to when you said you felt that hole in your heart? Was that something to do with a family member, your mother, or just plain life in general? How did you feel?
Well, I mean, I felt like that all the time. I felt like there was something lacking in me that everyone else had. I felt like there was something that I could, outside of myself, that I needed to put inside of me to make myself feel complete. So, you know, I was for approval from other people, or, you know, drugs or alcohol or achievement or overachievement or, you know, whatever size I thought I needed to be or the way I needed to look or the person I needed to date. I mean, it was always external things, and that never, you know, lasts. So it was exhausting.
Yeah. So, right. Oh, yes.
Achieving every goal except for myself and never finding any happiness, because, of course, that wasn't the right way to look. I needed to look inside of myself. So when I was pregnant with my daughter, I started having very vivid flashbacks, and which is apparently not uncommon. So I started going to trauma therapy and wasn't drinking when I was pregnant, of course. So I started having to get heavily into trauma therapy while I was having my daughter. And then after she was born, I had a very successful career as a trial attorney in a small town. And after there was a natural disaster in the small town, my family and I moved back up north, and between the natural disaster, the moving, and discovering that my business partner embezzled all of the money that we had made in our law firm, because I picked a business partner who would re-traumatize me just like a romantic partner. Anyway, that triggered sort of a nervous breakdown. I turned to daily drinking, which then led me to realize I had to stop drinking, which then, in a roundabout way, was a blessing in disguise that brought me into the trauma therapy, which really was my main issue, I think. You know, I felt that I had this hole in my heart because I think my psyche had literally been broken open as a child. And I was able, in this wonderful rehabilitation hospital that I went, was able to re-examine all of these decisions that I had made when I had sort of bought into and signed up for all of the brainwashing that my family, you know, unintentionally did to me, because they didn't know any better. They didn't have the ability to do the work and break the cycle. So, I mean, I just feel like those of us who are survivors, who are able to talk about it, yes, it's been awful road. Yes, you know, I'm not sure that all of us can survive it. I know not all of us can survive it. It's terrible. It nearly killed me, but I feel that we need to start to speak about it. And as you said in the beginning, from the mission statement, you know, prevention, my God. I don't know if it's a rescue fantasy that I have or not, but I look back at my history and all the schools that I went to and all the problems I got in and the red flags and the arrests and then this and then that. You know, if someone outside, one of those teachers could have said, hey, this child has complex PTSD. She's not a demon. You know, maybe we get her some therapy.
Right.
You know, I just think, you know, I didn't even get sober until I was in my late 40s. And if I could have saved that poor little girl that I used to be, all, you know, 35 years of drinking and drugging and hating myself, and just know that I was never evil. I was just a wounded child doing the best I could to survive. And that understanding,
that's right,
that was all I needed to really understand and free myself that self-loathing.
Mm-hmm.
And now
That's it right there. You just said it. You know, so often. Now, you have to remember, years ago, they didn't know that much about, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. They always looked at it as, you know, like the guys who came back from the service, right? Because they'd been in war, and a lot of times they were in the front line and all this other stuff. And so certainly they had PTSD. But it's just been more recent where they've linked together PTSD with child abuse, okay, where they're looking at it in a different way, in a different light. So, you know, a part of me, I see a lot of you and me and vice versa, because I would always think back, why couldn't they see, you know, why couldn't they see that there was something wrong with me? And there was a reason for it. I wasn't just a bad kid or an evil kid, as you put it. There was something going on with this child, and yet they didn't seem to know what it was, nor did they seem to care, you know, just to move away, go away, whatever, just stay out of my way. You know, I don't know what's wrong with you. So so often we grow up in families like that, and they label us as bad kids and so forth. And, you know, and here we are, children who have a story to tell, just like what you're doing right now, and so many before you and so many more after you. And we find that we all have certain things in common. And those things in common, of course, is like that hole you were talking about in your heart and, you know, feeling alone, feeling different. I felt dirty. I always knew that it was wrong, and it wasn't my fault, but I felt dirty. You know, I just felt so dirty. I just really did. And, you know, it's like we're walking around with a sign on our head that says, abuse me. You went into your adult life and you chose poor partners. I did the same thing. So many of us do, you see. So we who have been abused have so much in common. Our stories may be different, but we have the same feelings, and a lot of times we make the same mistakes, you know. So let's go on with your story, because it says here, as she is growing, I'm currently working on my first novel, a murder mystery, which I hope will bring awareness to this important issue. Tell us a little bit about this. And this says here, pre-COVID, I spoke. Well, we'll get into that. Tell us about your the novel that you're working on. Go ahead.
So it's a murder mystery. It'll be set in the Florida Keys where I used to live, and it is a sort of cat and mouse detective, female detective, who is sort of drawn to being a homicide detective for many of the same reasons that those of us who have trauma histories are drawn to being social workers, criminal prosecutors, et cetera, you know, these jobs that tend to re-traumatize you, right? But also I should speak for myself. I think that I was very codependent and became a criminal prosecutor because I felt the need to, you know, try to save everyone in the world to avoid looking at the chaos in my own life and to try to perhaps live out my little rescue fantasy that I could help some other abused child, right? So that was kind of interesting. So there's a dynamic between the female defense attorney and the female detective, both of whom may or may not have trauma backgrounds, and the cat and mouse game. And it's one of the characters is a very thinly veiled version of me that gets away with murder because I had to have a little bit of cynical fun and have revenge in the fiction world. Because part of my story is becoming spiritually enlightened and doesn't allow me to live out my murder fantasies in real life.
Right. I'm sorry for laughing, but even way back when I was 7 years old, I felt like murdering one of my abusers. He was a terrible pedophile. And it goes through your head. I don't care how old you are, because you're being so abused, and you want justice, and a lot of times there is no justice. And then so what you did
is
in all the studies and all the studies that you took and all the things that you became, a lot of us are gravitated actually towards work like that, because we are trying to, look ahead and fill, you know, all these kinds of feelings that we have inside. Justification has to come some way, somehow, somewhere, okay? So that's why I work here, you know, with NASCA, working with child abuse and also the adult survivors of child abuse. So you say here that that you by the time you're in your, you know, like in your 40s or somewhere in your 30s or 40s, you realize that you had blocked a lot of different things. Where were you? What happened that made you realize this? Was it when you had your first child? Is that what you had said? I remember you saying that. You started to have all different kinds of feelings. Is that what you were referring to? Oh, I don't think someone can hear me. Oh, my God.
She dropped.
We hear you. We don't hear her.
Oh,
yes.
That's what happened. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was my phone or something. All right. Well, okay, that was interesting. Hold on a second. Does someone want to try and call her back?
I'm sure she's probably trying to call back in. Give her a minute. Yeah.
She's, I just wanted to give her time to breathe and not, you know, go through it so much. Maybe she's triggered a little bit. Sometimes this happens.
Oh. Right.
Yeah, it could very well be.
Oh, she's getting on a plane, she said, and she lost it.
Oh.
So
she's getting on a plane. She's ready to take off. She's always running, isn't she? Okay.
Yes.
I was trying to slow her down a little bit at times by going back so she could, you know, get into feelings. And you guys were asking wonderful questions and making very good comments. So I wonder if she's going to, I don't know if she's going to be able to call back, you know, from a plane. But, you know, see, this show is what we talk about on the show all the time. You know, some of us become perfectionists. You know, this is what we do. We become, you know, perfectionists. And we want so badly to please people and to please ourselves. And I was going to ask her about, she was trying so hard always to please her mother. And I can identify with that because I tried so hard at times to please my mother to get my mother's love. And that's so often, we don't have the love and the nurturing that we need from our parents. And, you know, and it just makes the cycle of abuse to ourselves even worse. Then I drink more, you know, things like that. So we got into that where she was drinking. She had a problem, and she is an alcoholic, and I wanted to speak a little bit more about that. And then all of a sudden she has dropped. Does anybody have a comment that they'd like to say about her story, what she was telling us?
Hey, I do. This is Darlene.
Okay. Go ahead, Darlene.
I think I know Jessica. I think I do. But I'm not going to say how because it's privileged information, you know.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
She is a strong woman. And this is very hard for anyone to talk about. And I like the fact that she can turn the anger around towards these horrendous people that cause so much damage to our young lives, where she could turn it around in a mystery like that. That is wonderful,
right?
You know,
without
active help and feeling, you know, these feelings that you have, like you just want to hurt somebody. How about writing in a book and do a murder mystery? That's wonderful.
I think that's pretty cool the way she did that. Actually, you know, I really do. I'll be looking for a book when it comes out, you know, if we ever find out what the name of the book is. But, I see what she was doing, all right. But you see, she was running from herself so often. That's what she was doing.
We all seem to run away from ourselves or try to. You know, like back when I was, after my divorce, I was able to be myself a little more. And so I did some of the acts that usual teens do. You like go to the bar, try a little bit of drinking and stuff. But I was hoping to drink to forget, and I couldn't. No matter what I was doing, I was remembering it the next day. I just like, how come all these people drink and they forget everything? I want to forget for a little while, you know? And I said, well, that's not the answer for me. So I was just so agitated. And luckily for me, because if that would have worked, I might be an alcoholic right now. If that would have been
I think with Jessica, now you seem to know who she is. You think you do. From the get-go, I think she was very, very, like, nervous and, like, she's very jumpy. And, you see, I used to be like that, too. I was so hypervigilant. And I've learned how to – that's why I told her to take a deep breath because, you know, I had to learn how to slow myself down when I spoke because it just went brrr, like everything was like that. Everything was speed. Everything was fast. Everything, I turned into an athlete because I had to run. And I feel like she's still, like, going around this cycle of running. And who knows where she's flying. I don't know where she's going. I don't know.
The thing about it is, imagine, I would be nervous and jumpy if you're at an airport, you know, I'm just thinking, she might actually be at the airport and having to make sure nobody's hearing the conversation. You
what
know
she's
what
saying. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
it's not a good place to be to try and run a show. No, go ahead. Yeah.
No, but yeah, but she at least doing her best to tell us her story, and I really admire her for that.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. I kudos to her. If she does listen to this later, you know, Jessica, I want to thank you for coming on. You have quite a bio here. And she says, I'm currently, yes, working on my novel, the mystery novel. And she said she spoke regularly to local recovery groups and institutions about her journey of recovery and hope. And that's what I wanted to get into. Jessica wants to help others. It is time to stop the cycle of abuse. We are the lucky ones. We have each other and these forums for support. Our predecessors and perhaps our own abusers didn't have that outlet or opportunity. We are too many times ignored. It is time to speak out and prevent the next generation from the devastating lifelong effects of child abuse. Yeah. And, boy, that's true. And that's what we're trying to do. That's what we do at NASCA here. We try so hard to educate people so that they can learn what the cycle is, you know, learn about abuse, and also learn about themselves. They have to come in touch so often with themselves. We all do. Like, we can fix ourselves, but we can't fix others. And, you know, we can't change what happened to us in the past. And that's why I always say that was then and this is now. And now we have to deal with us today.
Okay.
Bill, is there something maybe Bill wants to say? Hold on a second. Go ahead.
I'm unmuting myself. I think she's doing fine. I don't think she was that nervous. I think she was doing fine. I'm not sure how many of these shows she's done before. And just the experience of doing even a different show the first time can make you sound that way, but I think she's doing fine. I'm very grateful that she made the she gave herself the opportunity, but gave us the opportunity to hear her. And I think, you know, several of the things that she said really rung true for me. The main thing, like I said just a few minutes ago, the last comment I made, the isolation and the pain and even the anger are quite common, you know, in different degrees. Not everybody has everything, but many of us have lots of things. And we identify, we hope, with we want the newcomer, the person that's listening, to identify with what they can. And if they can't, that's okay. They'll hear other stuff on another episode with another guest that they'll identify with someday. Because you don't get here by mistake. You know, people show up on our show or listen to our show because they themselves have an issue with this, whatever it is. Maybe they haven't yet even admitted that they are kind of eligible for recovery, but that's okay because that too is a process. And she mentioned something to the effect, this is a while back, she mentioned something to the effect that she didn't resent her responses to her trauma because that's what brought her to her recovery. I think she was talking about drinking at that point, but I identify with that. Totally identify with
me
that.
Me too.
But if I had not been the obsessive compulsive and, you know, addictive personality that I am, I wouldn't have had enough pain. Frankly, you need enough pain to stop doing it your way and to start listening to the recommendations of those who have come before you and are on their healing journey. None of us want to do it different. You know, we want to do it our way, damn it. And it's not working, and that drives us insane. We call that insane.
Right.
So actually the pain is beneficial because if it can get you to the point where you don't want that much pain that way ever again, then you're in the right place to start your healing journey. That's what it took for me. It doesn't matter, though, if you're 40 or 50 or 70. You know, it matters
right.
that you get started, you know. So thanks for letting me share that, Carol.
Yeah, no, that's good. I'm glad you did do that. And it's so true. I mean, we have to be ready, you know, and she is seeing a therapist, and there's nothing wrong with seeing a therapist. And I want to tell people out there that, you know, remember, the therapist works for you, okay? So often people don't quite realize that, and they have a hard time finding a therapist that understands because they don't understand child abuse. So if you are out there and you need help and you want to see a therapist, make sure that they have, you know, they've been schooled in child abuse, that they understand what child abuse can do to you and how it can affect your life. You know, it's so, so important. But anyway, let's see if William has something to say. That was a quick exit. She's flying away. Go ahead, William.
She's doing pretty good from the sound of what she's talked about. Because is she still a practicing attorney, too?
I think so.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I think she's probably still a practicing attorney. In fact, she's overcome a lot. And that's what a lot of people that are attorneys and things, they have a tendency to go into that to help others. And that's how they come into the legal end of things.
Right.
That's how I got involved in it, too.
I heard that. But anyway,
what was that?
Well, you know, it's, I don't know, somebody was laughing or something, I don't know. But, well, you know, that's so true, though. I mean, look at so many of us, you know, who went through all different kinds of things. You know, like Bill, look what he's drawn to. He put together NASCA and then the recovery groups and things like that. And the type of jobs that I always had were all social services and so forth, and working with kids or working with adults, working with the system in one way, one capacity to another. I'm fingerprinted all throughout New Jersey now. And then, you know, on and on it goes. And Darlene, she's the ambassador for Tennessee. And she wants to work with people. And by the way, if there's any ambassadors listening tonight, for heaven's sake, feel free to call in at least once a month. Feel free to do that. That would be a good thing if you did do that, okay? And then I can say, or Bill can say, or whoever's running the show, Pamela, whomever, you know, this is so-and-so, and they're ambassador, and they'll give the state that you're ambassador of, okay? And then that way you get more phone calls, too. And so, you know, we do an awful lot. And we seem to be, many of us, we the survivors, the true survivors, we seem, and activists, we tend to gravitate towards jobs that are, you know, whether it be in the legal department like she was in and so forth, the prosecutor, and or whether it be in social services itself, or working with kids, working with adults, one capacity or another. And this is what we do. I heard just a couple days ago that someone in my area was listening to you know, our show, which made me feel good because they're different than I am around here. And, well, you know, I didn't know if they'd take interest, but they do. So you never know who's listening. You never know. And we're certainly talking more about child abuse today than we ever have. And, you know, that's a good feeling that people are starting to listen. Now, we've got a pandemic going on. We have problems in the streets. We have all kinds of things. Supposedly the pandemic, the COVID is settling down a little bit. Let's hope that's true. We can get back to somewhat of a normal type of lifestyle. And I can get back out doing what I like to do, and the rest of us can breathe some, maybe, you know, some fresh air, if it is fresh. I don't know what's going on here. So, but anyway, she was an interesting person, but like she made it very clear in the beginning, she pushes and pushes and pushes and pushes herself. And I think she's still doing that. And this is what people do a lot of times who have been abused, is they push and push and push and push themselves. And maybe become overachievers. Bill's used that term, and I think that's quite right, because they're still running from themselves. And you know, they've come in contact with, I just got a, I don't want to watch the news on my phone. No, I don't. But anyway, you know, they haven't, it's very hard when you're in recovery. And you go through different stages when you're in recovery. We all know this on the show because we're survivors. And, you know, you go 5 steps forward, you go 3 steps backwards, and then you start over again. And you have to think about, what do I want to be when I grow up, okay? Because we didn't have a childhood, so many of us, you know. So that's what we're doing. Let me go to Darlene. She had started to say something before. Go ahead, Darlene. Now go to Pamela.
Okay, I was wondering, okay, the people, they need to realize that also be sure you find someone that is reliable where you can share your story with, because I noticed sometimes when I first started, I shared with the wrong people, such as, I'm not saying somebody that goes to Oscar Brown. I mean, some guys were so vulgar that they actually, their tongue was hanging out, like they were getting excited about, you know, hearing about me being sexually molested as a kid. That's scary as heck.
Yes, it is.
So,
yes, it is.
Sure, you tell the right person.
Who's Bow Wow is going nuts?
But
is that someone's door?
I'm not sure.
It's Jack. He wants some rice.
It's your Bow Wow. Is your doggy's doing that?
He's getting all excited because mommy's preparing a little rice for him. There you go.
Oh, okay.
Now he's eating. It'll be quiet.
Oh, he's so cute. He used to tell me he had a funny-looking dog, and then I saw a picture of it, and the dog is really very, very, very cute. But Pamela, what do you think about what happened here? You had spoken to her, I believe. I sent her an email, but you had spoken to her. Go ahead.
Yeah, she messaged me and said she was getting on a plane and thought that the show was only only an hour. She didn't know that it was 90 minutes.
Okay.
So
anyway,
she scheduled it. You know, she scheduled it around what she was going to do. So no, she didn't. She didn't drop just to drop. She thought the show was shorter. And
no problem. She did a great job. I thought.
Yeah, no, she did. She absolutely did.
Talked to her before the show. She said she told her story many times, and she wasn't too nervous to come on the show. She said she hadn't shared in this type of venue before, but that she's told her story over and over again. And yeah. when she shared her bio with me, she said that before COVID, she was regularly sharing her story in recovery groups and institutions. And, you know, she's an advocate. She's a strong advocate. So, I'm not worried about her.
No.
So,
and she didn't realize it was an hour and a half. See, And she was going to get on a plane, so she was in a hurry. Go ahead.
Yeah. The thing we were struggling with describing a few minutes ago was how our sense of ourself when we're a child and a young adult drives the choices that we make, including things like career choices. In her case, as William pointed out, she became an attorney, a prosecutor because of this. Mm. Other people become teachers, others become counselors, others become medical personnel, others law enforcement officers. These are all what you call service industries. And I think it's our desire to, even if we don't understand ourselves, to help others, you know, through whatever trauma and adversity. Let's say the word adversity, because they may not have childhood trauma. I mean, the point is that they're all legitimate paths to healing too, just not from your own trauma. You have to specifically do the trauma recovery, I think. But in the same time, you know, the law enforcement officer or the nurse you know, they want to put themselves into the position to be, I just call it being of service. I'm having a, mm-hmm. Right after this show, I'm having an appearance that's dealing with, community policing. And it's about the number of rape kits that have now kind of piled up again. And we have to find a way to get them resolved so that we can move forward on some of the prosecutions that obviously will result, because so many people are now required to give their DNA when they're arrested, all of them once they're convicted, that there's a huge, CODIS database where we can resolve these things, but we have to have the kits produced first, or the kits processed first. Anyway, the point is that, I don't only do this and you don't only do that. We do other things too. They all matter. Some in our church. We do it in our church. But it's just plain being of service. And that's the terminology that I use.
That's so true. That's so true, Bill. Because as soon as I can, who knows when that's going to be, I'm going to go back to New York City and work with the homeless, because I enjoy doing that. I enjoyed the preparation of the food, and we were so lucky in Hackettstown, okay, because a lot of people, I want to get this out there, a lot of people did give to this one church. It was called the Midnight Run, and it was a Methodist church. I'm not used to Methodist churches, but they do good work. And we would go into the city, and before we did that, we had, people gave us brand new, many things were brand new. A lot of the things came from Walmart. That's fine with me. I go to Walmart, too. I don't care. Hey, look, you need a pair of gloves, you need a hat, you can run right over into Walmart. So we had tons of clothing and even underwear. We had toiletries. Everything was all different sizes. We prepared the food before we left, and that was the soup in the wintertime. This is when I was working with them into the spring. But and then the COVID hit. But, the soup and sandwiches, and they weren't chintzy sandwiches either. We put a lot of stuff on there. And potato chips. And I was telling Pamela, I think it was, and maybe even Darlene, too. We were out there one night, and this fancy car pulled over. We were by Broadway area there in New York City in Manhattan. And there was a park there. And that's where we were working from. And so, anyway, this guy pulled over, and he said, are you the Midnight Run? And so they all said in unison, yes, this is what we said. And he said, well, you people saved my life. You saved my life because, a year or two ago, I was in so much trouble, and I didn't have any clothing, I didn't have any food, I didn't have any shelter, unless I went to the shelter. And people have to understand out there that the shelters are not always a good place to go, because there can be, especially if there's not enough people working in there, it can be a dangerous place to go. And that's why there's so many homeless people. They try so hard to make it on their own, because what little belongings they have, they don't want stolen from them, okay? And there's all different kinds of abuses in the shelters, too. You have to get that, straight. So, anyway, he said, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And away he drove. So you see, what we do, whether we're working in soup kitchens on the side or with the homeless and actually hands-on, or whether we're on NASCA here, trying to help people who are struggling on their healing journey, the survivors, and hoping that people get onto their healing journey. I, of course, take phone calls in the middle of the night. I had four the other night, three the night before that. I never know how many I'm going to have, and that's fine because I'm used to working all different hours. This is what we're here for, because, like you said, Bill, we're service, and we do, other things other than NASCA, and NASCA in itself is a big thing to do. So if anyone out there is feeling lonely right now, or they're scared, or they have questions and things like that, and you need someone to talk to, you can always go to the list of people that we have. If you go right to the front page of the NASCA website, you'll see Contact Us. And you go to the contact page, and there's a lot of names there. And I'm the Night Owl. I don't know if I'm the only one right now or not, but I am the Night Owl. And, you know, you can call, you know, and I'll talk to you. And I just need to sleep sometime in there. So, like, from 7 o'clock in the morning on, I usually tape a, you know, I go to bed is what I do. I take my shower and I hit the sack. So my hours are different than a lot of people's hours are. So, but if you need someone to call, the contact list I think has approximately, I haven't looked at it recently, but I think it has approximately 40 people on there. And Pamela and I think are going to go through that contact list and make some phone calls and see if they're still available, see who are, who aren't. But we ask that you come on the show, you know, and tell your story, and then you too can be on the contact list. And you don't have to be an AM person like me, okay? I choose to do that. We have people around the clock, though, that you can speak to. And I think that's pretty good right there. Now, we're coming down to the end of the show, and the guest that we had to catch a plane, and she's out there fighting something. I don't know quite what. But she does have a book that's coming out, and it's going to be interesting to see this book. I hope she does come back, or maybe she'll contact one of us and tell us what the name of the book is going to be. And she didn't realize that it was an hour and a half show. She thought it was an hour, and she had a plane to catch. So I want to thank you, you know, Jessica. If you listen to this later, and we do have the archives, you can listen. We're thanking you for coming on. You had an intriguing story, and we all understand how you feel and felt, okay? So it's almost time for me to end the show. Does anyone want to say one thing before I end the show? I guess not.
Well, okay, I'll say something fast.
Okay.
You know, I used to work with a lot of individuals, and the newest individuals there were often scared, you know, to get a little more involved. But I would point out to them that actually, as a new person, you have a kind of a special gift that I no longer have because I've been in recovery a long time, and people can't identify with me anymore. You know, with decades of recovery. But they can identify with someone who's been around for a few months or a year or two. And so when you're new, I feel you have this special opportunity to be the reasonable guide, reasonable goal for the newcomer who comes on. So a person like her who told her story tonight, and perhaps we heard her, you know, being unsure of how to do it. Not that she hasn't shared before, but not on this forum. That's fine. The point is, you get out and you do it, and that's what she's done. And that's what I share with newcomers, too. Get out and do it. Just don't lie. You know, as long as you don't lie to anybody else, you can carry the message just like everybody else, because when someone asks you something, you're going to have an answer, and when you don't have an answer, you're going to know who to go to. You'll call Carol, you know, or you'll call Bill, or you'll call Pamela, or you'll call Darlene. You know where the recovery shows are. You know how the recovery group is. You know the nighttime, five-night-a-week shows are. You know the website. You know a lot of things that the newcomer doesn't know, the person newer than you. So I'm just saying, Carol, that my message would be if you feel you're too young to in recovery, even if you're 55 years old, that you're scared because you might say the wrong thing or you don't know what you're – you know, you don't know everything. Guess what? I don't either. So, you know, step through the fear and start sharing because you are the goal for the person that's brand new in a way that Carol and I can never be again, hopefully. You know, we're not there. We're in a different place, and we understand that. But we also know there's people around us all the time who can. And so that would be my final comment for tonight, Carol.
Okay. Well, I thank you for that. I'm going to have to wrap the show up now because I have this in my ear. The show is over. I want to thank everyone that came on the show, and I really appreciate that. And I'll be talking to you soon. Of course, on Monday, we'll start over again, Monday through Friday. We're here, okay? So good night, and God bless, and I'll talk to you guys soon. Bye.
Stay away from the bears.
Yeah, you bet. Oh, God. I was scared last night.
I had a pop-up when I was trying to do the thing so I could say, be sure to call me. You're welcome anytime, you know?
I hear you. Whoa, all right. Good night, everybody. Love you. Bye-bye now.
Good night. Love you.